There's so many additions and changes in just the past few years for children and adults. We're going to go through the rationale behind many of them. But first, let's get some perspective on the history of vaccination and how patients and the general public are thinking about vaccines today. To learn more about these issues, we visited with experts, including our friends at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The development of vaccines is one of the greatest breakthroughs in modern medicine. Vaccinations have wiped out the threat of smallpox, polio, rubella, and other once dreaded diseases.
Vaccinations are one of the major reasons that health has improved so much in the United States during the 20th century. At the beginning of the century, diphtheria was a major cause of death of children. In the 1950s, there were epidemics of polio that terrified parents. In the 1960s, there was a global epidemic of rubella, which caused thousands of miscarriages and birth defects in children. We can now prevent these diseases with vaccination. So we're really talking about thousands and thousands of lives being saved every year by vaccination.
U.S. immunization coverage rates have risen steadily since the mid-1990s. And childhood rates have continued to hit record highs each year.
The immunization rates are, in general, for the individual vaccines above 90%. That's pretty good. We have the school laws to bring them from 90, 92% on up to 99% or so to catch up the stragglers. For each birth cohort vaccinated, society saves around $43 billion and about $10 billion in direct medical costs are prevented. At the same time, 33,000 children don't die from vaccine-preventable diseases who would, and it prevents 14 million cases of vaccine-preventable disease.
Adult immunization rates have also risen, while compliance is still below 50%.
It's been 15 years since you last had a tetanus booster.
When we start looking at adult vaccines, we get into a whole different animal, because these are vaccines that we don't have a set schedule of visits that are designed to promote vaccines. On the plus side, we have far fewer vaccines to try and deploy in adulthood than we do in childhood.
Despite vaccines' life-saving benefits, there are obstacles, and the vaccination program has been a victim of its own success. The result is occasional outbreaks of disease.
Public health officials haven't seen anything like it in years.
1,300 cases have been reported so far. There have been 4 deaths.
Due to the outbreak of measles, we urge to immunize the children.
The threats out there continue because of a growing yet very small percentage of people who either avoid or take different schedules. I think people have greatly forgotten so many of the vaccine-preventable illnesses because we just don't see those anymore. They don't occur in our usual practices. They don't occur in our homes.
In the absence of seeing the disease, some parents do get more concerned about the risks of vaccine than the risks of the disease. And of course, the irony of it is, the reasons we don't see the risks of disease in the community is because most parents have accepted vaccination for their children.
Even though concerns over vaccines have risen, CDC statistics indicate that less than 1% has chosen not to vaccinate their children at all. A higher percentage has delayed vaccines or remains under-immunized.
Vaccines are safe, they're very effective, and we have the knowledge that they are a great benefit not only to the child but to society. Parents are going to come with a number of concerns based on what they've heard, what they've read. It's very important for physicians to keep up to date with what the concerns of parents are, what the theories are for MMR and autism, thimerosal, giving multiple vaccines at the same time. The physician needs to address some of the misinformation that parents have, as well as some of the hesitancy or concerns that they have about giving particular vaccines to their children.
The scientific studies are very strong and they're very convincing to scientists. But I think what convinces parents is that that doctor who's sitting there talking to them really cares about their child, knows their child, and is making a recommendation that's based on that child's best interest. If they don't believe that, it won't matter what the studies show.
Research shows that parental decisions about vaccines hinge largely on the advice of primary care physicians and other healthcare professionals.
Parents now have more concerns about vaccines than they have in the past, and that has been a challenge for practitioners because it means that practitioners need to spend more time discussing these concerns that parents have and making them understand the actual benefits of the vaccine compared to the risks of the natural infection.
Most parents have a high level of trust in their physician. And so when we're trying to combat this, it's very important not only to try and educate parents, but also educate physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and other vaccine providers about the long-term safety and the benefits.
We have very low rates of vaccine-preventable diseases in the United States right now. And we have high immunization coverage, and that's great. But it's very important for the health of our children that we keep these diseases in the medical books and not in our schools and our families and our hospitals and our cemeteries.
The piece talks about immunization programs being a victim of their success. And we see that a lot in public health. You know, the success in public health, I often say, is in the silence. It's what we don't see. It's what doesn't happen when we don't have outbreaks. And that's concerning and can be a potential problem because when we don't see, we don't have that constant reminder of the infectious diseases that cause significant disease and used to cause significant death, it's easy to start taking our eyes off the ball. It used to be that when you saw a child who was born with rubella, when you saw a child who got measles or mumps and the pain and suffering that they endured, it was a much easier proposition to get them vaccinated. But again, in these days that we see an absence of these diseases because of the successes of vaccine programs and vaccine development and vaccine administration, it becomes that much more challenging to remind folks that vaccines do work, vaccines are safe, and vaccines protect us from preventable infectious disease.
A new vaccination schedule is released every year, and one of the more recent changes has to do with expanding the influenza vaccination to all children. What's the rationale behind that?
Well, that recommendation is based on the fact that there's accumulated evidence that the vaccine is safe and effective. Also, that influenza, the disease, has significant adverse impacts from absenteeism from school, increased medical visits, increased parent time from work, increased use of antibiotics, all of which have a significant impact. And also, by expanding the coverage that way, it makes it much easier at a particular healthcare visit to deliver the vaccine without the need for any particular reminders.
HPV has gotten a great deal of attention recently. Why was it added to the immunization schedule?
Well, HPV, which is human papillomavirus, is rather recently come onto the scene as to its ability to cause certain diseases. HPV, we now know, is probably the single most common cause of cervical cancer, of which there, depending upon who you read, 10,000 new cases a year in the United States. This vaccine contains the strains that will protect against most cases of cervical cancer. In addition, HPV is responsible for genital warts. Genital warts are now probably more common as a sexually transmitted disease than any other sexually transmitted disease in the United States. It's not realized. Some people keep thinking that it's herpes, genital herpes, responsible for most cases, or gonorrhea. But in actuality, HPV is more responsible for sexually transmitted diseases than any pathogen at the present time.
We've seen rotavirus return to the schedule recently, and also some changes in recent years regarding meningococcal disease, pertussis, and hepatitis A. Let's go through each of these and help your colleagues understand why these changes were necessary.
Rotavirus is a significant cause of gastrointestinal illness of young children. There was a rotavirus vaccine that was licensed in the United States in 1998. It was only briefly used because it did cause an adverse event. It was associated with intussusception, and this was recognized within the first
6 months or so that the vaccine was used, we began to identify cases. And in the summer of 1999, the vaccine recommendation was actually withdrawn and the vaccine stopped being used because of this kind of bowel obstruction that had been seen. So the vaccine developers had to rethink the approach to rotavirus prevention. Fortunately, there were other vaccine candidates that had been developed, and very large studies were done that involved 60 or 70,000 infants for each of these two vaccine products. And the data that was presented to the FDA at the time they were both licensed pretty definitively showed that if these new vaccines were associated with intussusception, it would have to be at a much, much lower rate than the previous vaccine had been. So we all felt much better about that at the time those vaccines were licensed because there was so much information that had been obtained pre-licensure. Since the vaccines have been licensed, there's been very careful monitoring. And at least from what we've seen in the United States, the picture's been really reassuring. It's a great development for children globally, as well as here in the United States, because rotavirus is a pretty nasty disease.
And meningococcal vaccine?
Meningococcal vaccine is another vaccine that we've seen expand in terms of recommendations more recently. And part of that is a result of the fact that initial recommendations were made at a time when there was concern about the ability of the vaccine to be produced in quantities sufficient to reach a broader population. And so this specific higher-risk population was targeted at that time. As we've seen manufacturing be able to keep up with demand, the recommendations have broadened to include children who are older as well.
Of course, with meningococcal vaccine, what you're trying to prevent is meningococcemia, meningococcal meningitis, and all you have to do is see someone who has that process, which is so rapid and devastating, and if it doesn't cause the demise of someone, it may cause them to lose digits or extremities. It is really a devastating process, and when you read in the newspapers that from your various local colleges, for example, of someone at the school was admitted to the hospital with meningococcal meningitis and there's panic in the school and so on. And that's why the majority of universities and colleges in the United States really encourage and some require for admission the administration of meningococcal vaccine. And I think that's been pretty successful.
And I think meningococcemia is a good example of something that actually exists with other infectious diseases and viruses, too. And that is that it doesn't just necessarily affect the person who's infected. So in other words, lack of immunization and getting a particular disease did not just affect that person. In the case of meningococcemia, anyone who's exposed, had close exposure to that individual, then has to be prophylaxed. And so there's a widening circle of intervention that has to take place beyond just that individual. And I think that's a point that with the larger vaccine world as well, that immunizing an individual can have broad implications for a broader population, positive implications. Not immunizing an individual or lack of immunization can have broad consequences, negative consequences for a wider circle too.
And how about pertussis?
Well, pertussis seems to be making a comeback in adults, and it is being advocated that adults receive the pertussis vaccine in the form of DDAP for at least once and then get their diphtheria, tetanus, DT shots every 10 years.
And hepatitis A, Dr. Johnson, you certainly had some experience with that vaccination on a wide-ranging scale.
Right, and there are outbreaks of acute outbreaks of hepatitis A, but there are also areas, geographic areas, where you're more likely to see hepatitis A infection. And that really is the impetus for the recommendations for the hepatitis A vaccine to eliminate those types of pockets of infection and incrementally increase protection across the broader population to help eliminate those kinds of more acute outbreaks that you may see across the general population as well.